Hey, John McWhorter, welcome back to the Glenn Show, John.
Glenn Lowry, thank you for having me on this portentous day.
We are here August 28th, 2013, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. President Obama will address the nation and the world in a matter of hours, less than 2 hours from when we talk right now, at the commemoration of the 1963 March. And there's a lot of buzz and a lot of talk, and you and I have been talking about race matters here at blogginghits.tv
for years,
that's right. For years. And you, John McWhorter, are on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal today.
That is true today.
About how one might truly honor Dr. King's dream.
Yep.
And so I thought we might devote a little micro Blogging Heads conversation, a McWhorter-Lowry duet here, to that theme. How can we most effectively in 2013 honor the dream first given voice to 50 years ago by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
Yep.
Why don't we begin, John, with you of Columbia University and the New Republic magazine and other such high-level venues, telling us, you know, just what you're arguing in the Wall Street Journal and how you look at this day. This is a momentous day 50 years after the crowning public event of the Civil Rights era.
You know, that's a good exercise for me to summarize it orally in a useful way. The piece in the Wall Street Journal is meant to say the following thing. There is work that remains to be done 50 years after that speech was made. But I think, and I genuinely believe this, that it's a mistake to think that the main work that needs to be done is to fight that which we now call institutional racism. I know that institutional racism exists. I know that there's a such thing as something you could call racism that isn't about somebody calling you a dirty word or Archie Bunker, but something more systemic. But I think that the idea that there was Archie Bunker at one point and now there's this new kind of racism, except it's just systemic, but it demands the same kind of indignation and attention, I think that's a mistake. I think that the things that we really need to work on now are concrete problems for the black community. None of them are fair, but I think that all of them, for the most part, are something different from the abstractions of institutional racism, and that if King were alive, he would be interested in us, say, working for the poor rather than waiting for a society free of institutional racism, because I don't think that that's a possible human society. That's what my piece basically is intended to say. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I hear two sub-arguments in what you just said, and I do think that's a faithful representation of the spirit of your piece, although there are phrases in there like quixotic cycle social experiments.
I meant that.
And
yep.
Black progressive ideology and so on that I think should be drawn out. But in any case, we've got the broad outlines of your argument on the table, and I see two themes. One is what's the problem, and then the other is what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the straw man whom you're attacking, I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but I mean it's a kind of stylized image, is a black progressive who believes that that is African Americans held back by institutional racism, put that in inverted commas, which needs to be opposed at every turn,
mm-hmm.
diagnosing the problem as needing to rid the world of institutional racism as blacks held back by the attitudes, thoughts, you know, practices of whites, by the discriminatory, tacitly now not so overtly, impediments imposed by whites.
Mm-hmm.
That's a diagnosis that I gather you reject. So that's part one of your argument. And part two is what to do. And conversations about race, policing the discourse, getting the Congress to, you know, strengthen something that the Supreme Court might have weakened in some law passed in 1965, marching, you know, public demonstrations and demands and insistence on symbolic expression and so forth,
mm-hmm.
Is not what to do.
And Glenn, may I very briefly add another thing,
yes,
just because it's
course,
current.
Of course.
Also, and something I have a piece on in the New Republic now, the idea that you would make a big deal out of little white Miley Cyrus shaking her behind in what we call the twerking manner these days and making a shout out to what she calls hood culture and calling this little white girl a racist for doing it and talking about it for days. That sort of thing. Continue.
Okay, I don't even know about that case, but that just goes to underscore your point.
You don't need to know any more than that.
Okay, and rodeo clowns.
Mm-hmm.
Rodeo clowns at the Missouri State Fair who are running around donning masks about the President of the United States and poking fun at the President of the United States.
Oh, I missed that one. Okay.
Okay, anyway, we could reproduce these cases. two parts to the argument. Diagnosis, Blacks held back by racism, wrong. Remedy, need to police the public and institutional practices of whites so as to advance the civil rights goal of no non-discrimination, also wrong. Now, how do I react to that? I resonate with it, John, although I must say as I read your piece, I chafed a little bit because I felt myself personally being one of these pointy-headed intellectuals whom you think spends too much time thinking about racism. I do think there's a case, a social scientific case, not a political case, for research like Mahzarin Banaji at Harvard, the psychologist implicit bias test that you indirectly poke fun at in a line in your piece, saying we don't need to ask people, you know, whether or not when they see racial images, their reactions to certain words are chosen differently, something like that. And what I would say to all of that is, to the extent that when police officers use deadly force in the blink of an eye, if their psychological processes are tainted by implicit bias, that's a question of science, then their training ought to be so structured as to counteract those biases, since indeed they will be deployed in racially, diverse neighborhoods and will be confronted with circumstances in which they have to make such life and death decisions. And so a whole line of inquiry that says there is racism that's subtle and that operates through the perceptual biases that causes people to associate blackness with negative connotations and then to act accordingly, to the extent that it's true, would be valuable for that policy reason. So I don't like that you throw out the baby with the bathwater. But having said that, and I'll give you a chance to talk, I think, you know, I mean, I went back and pulled my book one by one from the inside out, Race and Responsibility in America, 1995, okay, off the shelf. And the essays in there had been published in the 10 years prior there, too. And, you know, just as a way of kind of getting myself in the mood for the 50th anniversary celebration, wondering, yeah, what was I saying about this kind of stuff 25 years ago? And, man, I was saying pretty much exactly what you said in the Wall Street Journal today. Different time, different words.
You were.
But I was saying, come on, man, hearings on police brutality in black communities, when in fact the problem is criminality that is preying on African-American people, including little girls getting raped on their way to school in the morning and old people being robbed in their homes. You know, I said, you're never going to create a world, but you say that doesn't have racism in it. But if the skill gap doesn't get narrowed and if the behavioral differences within these communities, like out of wedlock, childbearing and all the rest, and the values that are placed on academic performance and all the rest aren't altered, and who can do that work? That's work that only the African American. So, yes, I embraced an idea of self-help. It's a somewhat dated term now, but I mean, the basic idea was take responsibility for the conditions of your lives. The opportunities here, while they might not be 100% equal, are way, way better than they used to be, and they are better, you know, they are such as to attract people from every corner of the globe to try to get here to do something that is your birthright. Seize your own future. Stop seeing your life as being played out in the minds of white people. You give them infinite power over yourself to the extent that you make them the arbiters of the extent to which you're fully human, fully a citizen, or fully standing on your own two feet. So, you know, more power to you, my brother, along all of those lines. However,
here's the thing. The piece that I wrote in the journal today is probably that's about as far to the right as I go. You know, it's I think over about the past 4 or 5 years, it's kind of gotten around that really I am very much a moderate. But that doesn't mean that a certain segment are going to ever find me exactly cuddly. And I would say that what I wrote today, and this was conscious when I wrote this. I wrote it last week actually. That is me kind of doing my best to be you 20 and 25 years ago. Even some of the phraseology. All I'm doing is the Glenn Lowry that I first started reading. Now, I want to say about the implicit bias tests, it's not that those shouldn't be done. I think that it's important that we know those things, and certainly those things play a role in police procedure, which I think is very important. But the main thing is, and Glenn, I don't know whether you're thinking about this or not, but this is an important point. You read those tests and you think, yeah, that happens with how the police often view young black men. For a lot of people, they will take a study like that, and they think, well, as long as that's the way Americans think, then what can you expect black people to really do about anything? There's racism in this society, that's how they're thought of, and until we can change those implicit biases, then there's no call for the black community to take any kind of responsibility for working society in such a way that things change. And notice that I'm not talking about self-help as in everybody goes off into the forest and builds their own community. It has to be within the system, which is run by white people, that we live in. But I think that we can succeed despite those biases. Those biases are an obstacle, and they're not fair, but I don't think that there could be a human society without them. Or if there can be, if we're going to learn about neurochemistry and, you know, psychological testing and actually spread it throughout the whole community, if we can do that, I'm guessing that's about 50 years in the future, and we don't have that long. And so I know that those things are important, but for many people, those things are the most important. Whereas I think you lived in a black community, being older than me, that did better than the black community that came along, despite biases like that that were a lot worse. We tend to forget that. You see what I mean?
I do see what you mean. I'm going to date myself, but I'm thinking of a book, I don't know if you know it, called The World of Patience Gromes. So this is a
book. I keep saying I'm going to read this. Yeah, go ahead.
I think his name is Scott Davis. I believe the author's name is Davis. Mm-hmm. Scott Davis, The World of Patience Gromes. It's a small little book, easily lost, 25 years ago. It's a history of Richmond, Virginia, in the years from like 1925 to 1970.
You told me about this once. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And it basically follows Patience Gromes is a African-American princess. That is, she's the daughter of free landholding African-Americans in the late 19th century in the hill country of Virginia. They were farmers. They owned their own land. They were very proud, stubborn, and tough people. And they came up out of Jim Crow in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And she marries a guy that ends up working for the railroad, which is a tremendous job. And they move into Richmond into a modest little house where it's on a nice street and they've got plants in the front and everything is everything, circa 1930, mm-hmm. 1935. By the time we get to 1960, we're on the road to hell, okay, in terms of urban failure and implosion. This author tries to tease out what happened,
mm-hmm.
and it's a complicated story, and it's controversial, you know, about the unintended consequences of public programs, about the rise of a generation that didn't share the values of this culturally conservative and in terms of lifestyle and manner, you know, frugal, hardworking, and, you know, rectitude and, you know, all of that. Into something else. And, of course, the 1960s happened and a whole huge change in attitudes. Of course, blacks become victims in a way that they had never been before. And, of course, a liberal ideology, not just black liberal ideology. That's one of the bones I want to pick with you. You know, you say a certain progressive ideology and you attribute it to blacks. But, of course, not all blacks hold it, and blacks are not the main proponents of it. Though
you're
we
right.
may be sometimes the victims of it.
That's very true.
But in any case, I'm just saying that world collapsed, okay? So that post-First World War generation of migrants,
mm-hmm.
of whom my grandparents were members, coming to Chicago out of Mississippi, and the post-World War II generation of migrants enter into the American opportunity structure at very different times. I'll talk about African-American migrants.
Mm-hmm.
Enter into the urban centers at very different times in terms of you know, the social economy of those places, and enter into the American imagination at very different times in terms of exactly what would you say to, you know, this movie that's out now, The Butler.
I haven't caught it yet, but that's right, yeah.
That contrasts the generations of the guy who is the actual butler and his son,
mm-hmm.
who's a fiery, you know, sort of in microcosm gives some voice to this tension of value and orientation about African-American striving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look back at Booker T. Washington through the lens of the 1960s, and he looks like a fool and an idiot. On the other hand, if you look back at him today through the lens of some of the 50-year after the Civil Rights Movement frustrations and unresolved problems of social decay within African-American communities and the emphasis on frugality and self-control
mm-hmm.
And upright living and
mm-hmm.
Thrift and hard work and all that don't seem quite as absurd
mm-hmm.
Today. So I'm not sure. I've been talking for a bit. Maybe I should just let you back in. But I think we're at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wheel is turning. Okay, the narrative is being rewritten.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama's two administrations, and as he enters into the pantheon of American iconography,
mm-hmm.
and his success as an African American and as President of the United States, come to be a part of memory and a part of history. You know, maybe he doesn't end up on Rushmore, but he's kind of metaphorically on Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King's bust in the halls of Congress, in the Oval Office, the memorial on the Mall. These things will be there 100 years from now, 500 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story is being written. The immigrants have come, are coming in very large numbers. This is a America unlike any America that a mid-20th century person could have possibly imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And race, non-whiteness, diversity, they are meaning very different things than the classic claims of the disenfranchised descendants of the slaves. We are no longer to be the major note in the minority chorus in this country.
Yes.
The Latinos outnumber us. The urgency of some of the public questions that are brought by that kind of diversity,
I would agree,
are overtaking the unresolved business of the civil rights era and so forth and so on. So this is a really critical moment, and it does matter what we say about this.
This is what it comes down to. What you're talking about with, for example, the Patience Groans book, is a matter of the fact that we as human beings, and this is no matter what color we are too presentist. And we now have this idea that it's higher wisdom to understand that societal racism and implicit bias, etc., are the reason that black people have problems. Now, most people would step back and say, I didn't say the only reason, but let's face it, most people feel that it's higher wisdom to think of that as the main problem. And all of that makes a kind of superficial, coherent sense, but then you think about black people in not even the distant past, but the recent past. Black people in 1930, 1950, even 1960, where things were undeniably worse than they are now in every way. And yet, life wasn't paradise, but people held it together. We tend not to think about that. Or, the answer that people tend to have is that what changed was that factory jobs moved away. And that one seems to have held a lot of water in the 80s and 90s. A lot of people who haven't had an opportunity to think about it still think that that's why things really went to hell in black ghettos. But I think, as you have written about before, and as I've written about, even that one doesn't work, and you don't have to get quote-unquote pointy-headed about it to understand that we can watch immigrants coming in right now and in those same communities, not living paradisical lives, but holding it together. And then some people say, how dare you compare us to immigrants because we were unwilling immigrants 200 and 250 years ago. And I think everybody realizes that, no, there comes a point when the main point is you could hold it together in this community, but you don't. Now, it's not a moral problem, as many people seem to be waiting for somebody like me to say. I think, rather, it's that the ideology has become that black people are a very special situation where somehow, right now, a bulldozer is going by, so I'm going to pause briefly. I am at a little...
Well, then I can start talking, John, because...
Real quick. I'm almost done. So the idea is that our case in humanity, all of humanity, all 150,000 years, is special, and that we can't fight. This is the final statement. We are insulted in being told that institutional racism means that things have to be the way they are. And that is what I find myself thinking 50 years after 1963.
Well, what can I say to that? I agree with it 100%, John. I really wish that I could argue with you about this point, but I don't think that would be doing myself or anybody else a service. It is true that within black exceptionalism, let me put that label on it, the idea that the history of African Americans in this country, and it has been a traumatic history, I mean, enslavement and second-class citizenship and social exclusion for centuries, liberated only within the last two generations, is unique, not to be compared, and that the ongoing maladies and difficulties within African-American communities, which are sometimes there to be seen alongside the progress and the successful incorporation and assimilation of non-white immigrants who have come to the country, ought not, you ought not to make that argument, you ought not to go there and whatnot. And you say, and I think it's absolutely right, while there may be certain theoretical observations, for example, migration as a selective process.
Exactly.
So the people who come to our shores are not a random draw, and hence comparing mean performance between populations will give you a biased estimate of whatever it is you're trying to say. That's all very true. at some point, the sheer weight of the historical process of incorporation shows that the opportunity is there, that the kinds of behaviors that people need to exhibit in order to take advantage of those opportunities are short in supply in many African-American communities.
Where they weren't in, say, 1925.
Where they had not been at some previous point in the past. Indeed, the world of Patience Grooms. And that if you want to see something look different, you're hardly going to get there by inveighing against this sort of implacable force on the outside, which is, you know, the derogation of white opinion or the limitation of opportunity from whites who provide it, since the Asian and Latin American and other immigrants, the African immigrants, are showing you exactly what's possible in this country.
African ones included, that's right.
Now, I want to say one thing, though, John. If black exceptionalism is to be criticized for the reasons I just tried to summarize, which you had set forth, American exceptionalism, sitting on a hill, rhetoric, greatest country in the history of the world, look what we've done, look how far we've come. When you look at the failure of educational institutions to bring opportunity to a substantially minority population in the inner cities, the depredations of the war on drugs and other misdirected processes of criminal justice, I would add wholesale stop and frisk policing in New York City to that list, which have the impact. But the huge disparity of public health and quality of life, obesity, HIV, and so forth and so on, these are all matters I know. The difficulty of reintegrating into the society people who will have paid their debt for having broken a law or whatever and been punished for it, but have a hard time getting back. These are matters I know that you are positively concerned about. They are indications of the extent to which African Americans remain to be disadvantaged, and even after we've apportioned due responsibility for that condition to African Americans ourselves, I think we still have to acknowledge that there is a public interest in seeing that these matters are more effectively dealt with, and that these are huge matters of public policy concern.
Certainly, although let me throw something back at you, which I think is equally important to what you said. Talk about American exceptionalism. Fish don't know they're wet, and we are fish in this case. And this is something else I touch on in the Wall Street Journal piece. We are very advanced, we Americans, in terms of how we deal with racism, although we are far, far from perfect and always will be. And that is that in this country, the way racism has been so social, become so socially incorrect so quickly, you compare 1963 and 1973. For example, you and I both know that editorials, especially in, frankly, high-profile places like the Wall Street Journal, where they can afford to do it to you, they get changed. And so that thing is about 90%. I take full responsibility, but that's about 90% me and about 10% little tweaks they made. One thing that I left out, one thing that they left out was I said, imagine that in 1963, when you turned on the TV, you got Petticoat Junction. Just 10 years later, you turn on the TV and there's Maud. How were there only 10 years in between those two Americans? And I mean, it's amazing to me. And what I'm getting at is that talk to many Europeans, especially beyond roughly England and Germany, about race. And you find people who are in 1960, what they'll say about Jews, what they'll say about gypsies, how they feel about black people. And then, frankly, and I don't know what kind of hate mail I'm going to get from Korea or whatever about this, talk to Chinese people, Japanese people, Thais about race. Frankly, talk to Africans about race. Everybody is vastly behind the enlightened Western European and especially made an American take on race, among, of course, a certain level of education.
It's not just race. It's also gender issues. It's sexuality issues.
We should be proud of that.
Some of these Africans about homosexuality.
Oh, for goodness sake,
There have been pieces in the New York Times recently about, for example, an African-descended politician in Italy being openly baited and called a monkey, in effect. Why don't you go back to your own country? And I think she was born in Italy.
There you go.
About the Minister of Justice, this woman in the socialist government in France, who is a very significant figure, but who has met with open, vilification and personal insult.
Glenn, let me stick something
of a racial sort that could never possibly be acceptable.
Glenn, let me stick
In American political discourse. So I take your point. Your point.
Let me insert something very quickly to make sure I don't malign certain people. Also, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland, Holland, Denmark. So that crowd, they are also very enlightened on this. But I think it all starts here. Otherwise,
well, as these immigrants have been coming, as the Muslims have been coming, as people from the post-colonial blowback have been coming, and refugees because of, population crises in various places in the world, and decent societies feel that they should take in some of these people. And so you end up in Scandinavia or whatnot with, people of a sort whom the societies have never had to confront and grapple with before. Very interesting articles I've read in social anthropology and sociology.
Mm-hmm.
On incorporating non-European immigrants into Scandinavian society.
Especially in those societies beyond a certain educated stratum. Yes, certain.
Indeed, exactly. The patina, the thin layer at the top of people who are part of a global consciousness of progressivity is one thing, but you don't have to go very far to get to some of these small towns of these working class factory districts or
and then the,
whatever
the troubles
where people's
start.
Attitudes are much rougher around the edges.
Exactly.
So, yes. The U.S. has...
We should be proud of that.
Has a lot to be proud of in that regard.
Yep.
John, I want to do something. I don't know if you'll allow it, but let me do it anyway.
Uh-oh. Okay? What are you going to do?
Obama's going to speak at the Lincoln Memorial 50 years after King's speech in a matter of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something. It's not in the Wall Street Journal like yours.
Oh, what did you write?
It's not quite as topical, but I want to just read from it and get your reaction, and it's going to take me a minute.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
This is an essay in a book called The New Black,
mm-hmm.
published by The New Press.
Who's the editor?
What has changed and what has not with race in America. And I have an essay in here.
Who's the editor?
Along with people like Orlando Patterson and Elizabeth Alexander
right.
and other such people.
Edited by who?
And, it's edited by Kenneth Mack and Guy Charles. These are two African-American lawyer types at Harvard and Duke, respectively.
Okay,
so here's what I say and get your reaction very quickly, and then we can conclude. And what follows, I argue that the prophetic tradition of critical political thought and faith-based moral witness out of which the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King emerged and which he embodied is radically at odds with both President Obama's electoral ambitions and his exercise of the powers of office. Neither is this tradition compatible with the president's rhetoric concerning the moral significance of his ascendancy. For the tradition of social criticism that emerged over the generations from the suffering of the slaves and that gathered strength from the unrequited hopes of the freedmen has always and necessarily been keenly aware of the moral ambiguity of the exercise of American power in the world. No mere politician, not even one as gifted at oratory as Obama, can afford to give public voice to such critical skepticism about the American project. And yet, to achieve the historical rightness of national conduct for which King gave his life, it is essential to challenge publicly the prototypically American boast that this nation stands as a moral exemplar. That's the end of the quote.
Mm-hmm.
And you see what I'm getting at with respect to black exceptionalism being wrong, but in my view, a certain kind of American exceptionalism also being problematic. And then I'll just conclude here and hear your response. I also want to stress that part of the witness, if you will, that is of the power of demonstration and example brought by the experience of African Americans has not to do with the condition of African Americans. Do we have this or that many jobs or educational achievement or low poverty rate? But has to do with the posture of the country itself, the United States of America, vis-a-vis the rest of the planet. And there, the lesson of the civil rights movement should be a humbling one for America, not one that encourages chest beating. And it is not going to be given full voice to by a president of the United States who, in the nature of the case, as president of the United States, cannot possibly stand at a critical repose vis-a-vis the American order, which is what the history of African-American struggle teaches us is necessary. Okay, so that's my thing. I'd like to give you the last word and let you say what you want to say about that.
Glenn, I'm going to make a prediction, and I'm going to be willing to fall on my face. I suspect that because of the contingencies of social history and where we are at this point, and given that Obama's in his second term, given that he's taken so much heat for not being progressive in the vein that you're talking about, given that we're in the wake of the Trayvon Martin controversy and he found that he could be critical of something very sensitive about the nation and the sky would not fall in, I get the feeling he's going to surprise us today. I don't think he's going to get up and say a bunch of needlepoint type things. I don't think he's only going to criticize from a distance and then get back to the singing and the short phrases and ending by saying something about God. I think that the nature of today is such that he knows he has to come up with something that people like you and me and Tavis Smiley and the rest would find worthy of someone of his education level and race and critical ability. I think we're going to hear something deeper, and if we don't, I am extremely disappointed and rather surprised at the man. So let's see what happens. That's
okay, John, let's see what happens. That's really excellent. We should watch it very closely.
And then we'll talk about it.
We can revisit it. But I appreciate the way you responded to my intervention. Let us see whether the president and the extent and the manner in which he rises to the occasion. Thanks so much for coming on.
Wonderful.
And talking with me, John. Look forward to, because John, everybody needs to know, is on vacation, okay? Serious vacation.
I am on Long Island.
He's taking his time out to talk with us, and I'm grateful.
I am. And then, Glenn, thanks for putting up with the scheduling difficulties, and let's talk about this speech very soon.
Okay. Take care.
Have a good one.
Thanks, John.
Glenn, this was-